Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, that's right. California does know how to party because ain't no party like a West party because a West Coast party just don't stop, y'all. Once again, thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of Inside the Octagon. This is your host, Kalani Lua. You guys can find me on Twitter at K11. That is K-L-U-A-1-1. And once again, this Inside the Octagon brought to you by the Sports Grid Podcast, which you guys listen to every Thursday evening between 6 and 8 p.m. Pacific time. That is the Sports Grid Podcast. If you guys are out there listening, you feeling in to chime in on what we're talking about on today's show, please do so at 718-506-1506. That is 718-506-1506. Got some hot topics to get to today. And really, the biggest hot topic to get to post-Super Bowl is what was going on this past weekend out there in Brooklyn, BK. Hey, New York, we had UFC 208 going down at the Barclays Center, and I got to tell you, you look around, not only on social media, but if you ask people who cover the sport, you ask people with inside the organization, got to tell you, UFC 208 wasn't its best show, and it's not a good way to start off 17, but the year started early, so we got a lot of great shows and events pushing to make up for it as time goes on, but UFC 208 is in the books. Attendance for Barclays Center was 5,628. The gate was 2,205,105. So not bad to pay numbers. Still going to be coming in to see what those look like. But we do have a new woman weight, that's 145 pounds, featherweight champion and Netherlands own Jermaine Durandamy after getting a unanimous decision over Holly Holm. And when you watch this fight, excuse me there, but in watching this fight, it was going into it, it was a build of two strong. Holly Holm, who comes from a boxing background, 33 wins, multiple time champion, kickboxing, and obviously we've seen what she's done at UFC, most famously getting a head kick knockout victory on Ronda Rousey in 2015. Accolades are well known. Jermaine Durandamy is a little less known to the casual, but she is one of the baddest female Muay fighters in the world. Muay Thai champion, kickboxing, defeated 40 plus fights in kickboxing and get there. So this was built up as, hey, striker to striker. We see some really good blows coming here, and we got some of it. Sure, we got some of it, but we were expecting. Did it live up to our expectations? And no, it didn't. And sometimes, you know, that's what happens when for main events, for fights in any sport, whether it's a team sport or a single sport, sometimes the match just doesn't live up to the height or the expectations going in, but that's all fine and dandy. But still in all, we got a lot of good display of striking, game planning on the part of both. On the part of both females, excuse me, once again, in this fight. Let me get some water here. In watching this fight, we saw, you know, lean into it. Before I get to the fight, lean into it. You're saying, okay, these are two strikers. You know, these are things. Durandamy is probably the best striker that Holly Holm's taken in her MMA career. She does come from Greg Jackson's, where they are known to game plan, and sometimes whether, you know, with John Jones, where they'll game plan for your strength. With John Jones, if you look at a lot of his fights, whenever he fought somebody, if they said better striker, Jones went in there striking with them. If they were a better wrestler, Jones went and wrestled with them. If they were a better grappler as far as submissions, Jones tried to go in there and would try to apply some submissions. Whatever it was, Jones to beat you at your own game. You got someone like a George St. Pierre during his time where It was a mix. One round, he'll strike with you. He'll wrestle with you. Third round, he'll mix it up. Kickboxing, a little jiu-jitsu on you, whatever he can get in. With Holly, thinking, okay, she's got a striking background, but going into this, considering who he is facing, will she look to stand up? Or maybe, just maybe, her camp will say, you know what? This lady does struggle on the ground. I'm talking about Durandamé here. So let's work on your takedowns. Let's get her to the ground. Let's put her on her back and let's go ahead and her weaknesses. The problem for this fight, never attempted any takedowns in her MMA career, at least in the UFC. I don't know if outside of the organization she tried going for, but in the UFC, she never attempted a takedown. Now, I know she got a takedown against Ronda Rousey, but Ronda Rousey initiating takedown. So, even if you want to apply a wrestling game plan, you're doing it with someone who's foreign to it. It's not something that they do. So it's very hard to expect for Holly Holm to come in there and look like a George St. or Daniel Cormier or something of that nature. But you did have the fight that she certainly was trying to close the distance, get her enemy against the cage, and take her down at will. Give credit to the as bad as she may be on the ground. She's horrible, but to be honest, when you spend your entire professional career in striking, making that trend in MMA, she did that back in 2013. It's only been three, four years. It's not easy to pick up on it right away for other people. So give credit to her. She stuffed, I believe it was 8 all takedown attempts by Holly Holm. So kudos to her again. That's not saying that, oh, you know, she's like Chuck Liddell now. You just can't count. No. Remember who she was going up against. Holly Holm never attempted takedowns before in her UFC career. So you got to say, you know, glass half full, half empty kind of look. But still in all, kudos to her going out there, stuffing the takedowns, keeping the fight standing. Now, keeping the fight standing, what I found interesting in watching this was Holly Holm was implementing the game plan of, I don't want to just stand here in the pocket and slug it out with her. I don't want to do that. I want to stay moving side to side, circling. And she would come in with a nice 1-2 and then finish off with a leg kick, which is good. You know, pepper the leg. You limit the movement of your opponent. Takes away one of their strengths, which is kicking. So if Jermaine's trying to throw the right leg and she's got a plan with that left one, with it being with the left leg, the way that with those kicks, it's really going to affect being able to plan and get a lot of it on it. And she tries to throw a left front kick, not going to be a lot of juice behind it because that leg is already worn down. And then if she goes in for the takedown, basically on one leg, you got it. So the problem was is that Holly Holm, because she was moving in and out so fast, she really wasn't getting a lot of torque on the leg kick, basically slapping Jermaine's front leg with her foot, which is all fine and dandy, but what you really want, from what I understand, and again, I'm not a kickboxing aficionado or a specialist, but just in my, 20-plus years of watching this sport, having, you know, playing Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter several times, look at it and say, well, the best thing that she wants to do is she wants to get some shots in there where the shin is hitting the leg. That's really where you're going to be able to get, especially if it's not checked, hitting right above the knee and that thigh area. You want to get your foot, ankle, and shin. You want to get all three of that hitting it. You want ankle, you want to get your shin popping on it so you get more torque on it going forward. But if you're so worried about being caught inside the box, moving in and out so fast, and you're only slapping it with the foot, that isn't going to be what you want. A perfect example would be you guys to watching the Quentin Rampage Jackson fight against Griffin, his second light heavyweight title defense, Rampage, that is, against Griffin. If you notice, one of the reasons Force was able to win that bout was because he peppered Rampage throughout the entire bout. Vicious hard leg kicks where by the fourth and fifth round, Jackson couldn't really take him anymore. I think it was the fifth round, Force threw a leg kick. And Jackson, literally put his hand on the cage, lift his leg up, and almost say, man, please don't ever do that again. Please, I don't know what I did to you. Look, just stop doing it. Please, don't do it anymore, okay? Stop it. Jose Aldo versus Faber when they were in the WEC. He nearly breaks the man's leg because he was putting a lot of torque on those kicks to the leg. So for Holly, good game plan. I just feel that if she was just in there for an extra second and really be able to turn those kicks, she could have done more damage on Jermaine's leg. Jermaine didn't really check a lot of them because she was sliding back. So, you know, again, kudos to her. I'm not just going to stand here and take it, but still, if Holly would have just said, stand in here just for an extra half a second or an extra second, get that extra half step where I could really put it into when I throw this leg, I really do believe that throughout the fight, we would have saw that come into more of an effect later in the fight. It really didn't have that effect as I'm sure Holly Holm's corner was hoping it would have as the fight wore on. But with these two phenomenal strikes, we did get some clashes where they were able to put it on this. Holly Holm was able to land a straight left cross that tagged and really did buckle Jermaine. Dropped her to her name, got right back up, though. But you could see that she was clearly wobbled. She even hit the clinch on Holly. And whenever they would clinch, and Jermaine would try to throw, you know, obviously her Muay Thai knees into the body, throw them up to Holly. But Holly did a very good job in not allowing Jermaine to clinch against the cage for periods of time. When Holly Holm would clinch with Jermaine and back into the cage, and Jermaine's back was against the cage, Jermaine, when she could, not every time, but when she could turn it and get all of the clinch from her angle and switch it to where now Holly Holm's back was against, you really saw that Muay Thai coming in where she was going right knees to the body, left knees to the head. And you can tell that Holly said, yeah, I don't want to be in this game much longer. So let me turn this back around. Let me push you off the cage a little bit, turn you around, and let me put you back up against the cage. And instead of me having clinch space where you can throw knees, I'm going to just lean in on you, let you carry my body, and I'm going to try to work for this takedown. Now, if you're watching the fight, and let's say you're not familiar with the grapple aspect of it, totally fine. I get it. But a lot of people realize that when you're up against the cage and you have a fighter leaning on you trying to get a time or leaning on you in the clinch, trying to work for positions, body shots, some dirty boxing going on, you don't realize you're sitting there as a fighter against the cage. Not only are you getting hit and not only are you trying to defend takedowns and bad positioning, you're also carrying the weight of another fighter on you as leaning to you. So even though we'll say, oh, well, come on, guys, do something, you got to understand, it's taxing on the fighter who's against the cage because they're carrying their weight, but the weight of their opponent, including all the other stuff I mentioned, block positioning, trying to, you know, watch out for big shots coming in. So that's a lot on for them as well. For the opponent who's applying the pressure against the cage, in this case, Holly Holm, she did a good job saying, I'm not going to tire. For an example, if you have someone in a guillotine choke, a front face lock, where they're bent forward, you're standing in front of them, you put your arm around their neck, squeezing it. In those particular situations, if you don't have your arm, your forearm, underneath the chin to where it's on their throat, where you can squeeze, and you're just holding it there, well, if you hold it too long or too tight and you're just squeezing it out, you can really burn out your arms. And then next thing you know, when you have to hold or go into the next round, your arms are a lot heavier. They're tired. You can't block. You can't throw your punches like you used to. In this particular one, Holly Holm did a good job in saying, I'm not going to wear out my arm trying to hold you tight. I'm not going to try to squeeze you. I'm not going to try to bear hug you. I'm basically going to try to get these takedowns. But if I can't get them, I'm going to lean on you more so than grabbing on you. So she will have a hold of her. But if she's trying to sit there and hold her with her hands and her arms, she would lean in on not allow Jermaine to get a lot of the space moving around. So in doing so, she really conserved her arms to save throughout the fight. So very on her, again, a very small detail, but still very effective. You saw as the fight wore on, Holly Holm did not tire from doing takedowns that did not work. She did not tire from constantly holding Jermaine's defense. She did not in that aspect that you would normally see a lot of fights do when they are trying to apply that. So kudos for her on that. Hats off to Jermaine, though, as I said, down and not allowing Holly Holm any advantage against the cage. A lot of times, when again, going into everyone knew that if Holly had any advantage, it would be to take Jermaine Durant down, get her on the ground. Jermaine said, yeah, I'm working on my takedown defense. I'm not allowing it. Still, you got to look at it and say with an asterisk, this was her first fight where that was her game plan. But still, Jermaine deserves like credit for going in there and saying, no, mas. No, you're not doing this to me. There was times where Jermaine looked like she was really in a bad position where Holly would either, where she would get her, where she would turn a little bit to the side, like her back is against the cage, and would turn to the left or to the right, and Holly would kind of slide to her backside from the front and almost try to get a side or a back waist lock on her to try to, pull her down. And Jermaine just wasn't having it, and she was saying, nope, and switch it, and then go back to the front, get the double underhooks, which Jermaine would take for double underhooks. Jermaine would take her arms, and she would slide them between her body and Holly Holmes and put her arms underneath Holly Holmes' arms like hooks, a.k.a. double underhooks. And then that would prevent Holly from being able to get a grip on her, on a hold on her. That way she couldn't get the takedown and put Geranium on her back. So hats off to her for doing that. And then the big controversy for this fight was at the end of the second round. The first one was at the end of the second round. You know, at the end of any fight, boxing, mixed martial arts, when 10 seconds come, you hear this. You hear the clapping, right? They take two sticks, two eraser pads without the eraser on it, whatever. Two wooden handles, whatever they use. And they clap them together. They indicate to the fighter, to the referee, and to the corners, there's 10 seconds left on. Referee, get ready to jump in and stop. Fighters, get ready, but 10 seconds. Corners, get ready so that you can get up in there. Because 60 seconds in between the rounds so you can get in there, help your fighter out if you can within that time frame. And we've seen fighters in those last 10 seconds give finishes, whether it's submission, TKOs, or go on flurry. Excuse me, I was about to say fury, but no. Flurry is where, the nice combinations to end the round. The most famous one is that if you look at the boxing, Sugar Ray Leonard versus Marvelous Marvin Hagler in their middleweight class, the last 30 seconds of the fight would just vicious combinations on Hagler every time. Not necessarily hitting him every time, but just throwing a big flurry to end the fight. Kind of leave that last one on the judges like, wow, Sugar Ray, he really did something there in that round. And in a way, they call that stealing the round. And sometimes that could sway to give you the round in the favor. So at the end of the second round, Jermaine does a left-right combination on Holly Holm. Holly's kind of backing up towards the fence. They're duking, standing there, going toe-to-toe, and Jermaine throws a left-right. The left lands when the horn goes off, right? But the right comes, and this is controversial, it comes after the bell, and the right hand decks Holly Holm. And clearly wobbles her, nearly knocked her out. Had there been, let's say, 2 seconds left and Jermaine landed that shot, Holly Holm probably would have been finished in that. But because it was the end of the round and the buzzer went off, Holly Holm let her guard down and Jermaine threw the last punch. Now, depending how you view it, because it is kind of subjective, you can say, well, Jermaine was already in the motion of throwing the right hand. And, you almost have to go frame by frame. But you can see that when she throws a left, when the bell off, Jermaine's right hand, it's like way cocked. It's not fully back. She didn't bring it from California. Well, she didn't take it from New York and go all the way back to Chicago with it. All back to California with it. She was kind of in Chicago with it, kind of in Indiana a little bit. I'm like, I'm kind of going to throw it. And then she throws the right. Now, when this happened, and obviously she cleared Holly Holm, the announcers, Joe Rogan, John Annick, Dan Mir, who did a fantastic job, by the way, three-man, it was something that they had to get used to, but if they continue to do that over time, I think it'd be very good. HBO Boxing shows you with Jim Lash, Max Kellerman, and Roy Jones Jr. that it can work just fine. So, an error, but I think the UFC, if they want to go their route, they need to be consistent going so that the announcers themselves can go ahead and get used to it going forward. Anyways, you know, they were even complaining, like, oh, man, that can have such an amazing impact on the fight later on. You know, how long, what if she doesn't recover for the next round? And you know, that could be something really is going to be, oh, that's a question mark, because that came after the round. And it's okay, you know, it happened. And, you know, these things happen sometimes. So, okay, Holly goes to the corner, comes out ready. Okay, you know, got it. Third round, let's go at it. Wobble, wobble, wobble. Shake it, shake it, shake it. Do what we do. 10 seconds coming up again for the end of the round. And this one, now they're going at it. And Jermaine does it again. The horn sounds, and she throws another combination at her efforts. And, you know, she kind of turns around, like throwing her hands up, but I don't know if it was like a smile, grin, or whatever. I don't know if it was kind of like that. Yeah, come on, this is what we're here for. We're here to fight. We're here to scrap. You know, Jermaine went to it, kept saying she wanted to fight, she wanted to scrap, she wanted a war, because that's what she do. And the referee, you know, breaks. Obviously, the fans are kind of booing, and the analysts are getting on her again. Hey, that fight, the referee needs to take a point away. Then the ref goes up and says, if you do it again, I'm going to take a point away. Rogan, Cormier was saying, no, he needs to be now. It's, you know, this isn't right. And the fans really let it be known that it wasn't right and that a point should have been taken away. On social media afterwards, yesterday and today, that's all people are talking. But here's how I look at it. If you go back to George St. Pierre versus Matt Hughes, the second time they fought, when George was Hughes for the title, George St. Pierre hit Matt Hughes with two low blows from throwing inside leg kick. He was throwing right inside leg kicks to Hughes. And when he was right foot on the inside of Matt Hughes' leg, his foot was up and hit Hughes' cup. The first time he goes down, got it, you know, St. Pierre's like, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, Hughes is like, let me just shake it off, you know, jump up and down a little bit, take a couple deep breaths. Okay, I'm good. You know, George, you know, does his back. Puts his hands up like, hey, I'm so sorry. Hughes is like, no, I got it, man. You're not a dirty fighter. I got it. They do each other. They go out there and do it. A few moments later, George throws another inside kick. Slides up, hit Matt Hughes low. And then everyone, oh, come on. He's trying to hit him nuts on purpose. George is even saying, I don't mean to. He, you know, he puts his hands up. Oh, my God. And Hughes is kind of looking like, dude, seriously, come on. You got to protect Julie's here. Come on now. I want kids. Big John McCarthy was the referee of that fight. And he even goes up to George and he says, look, I know you're not doing it on purpose. But when you throw on the kick side, your foot is sliding up. You either need to make sure it slide up or you don't need to throw that kick. If you do it again, I might have to take the point. Now, that's in the heat of the fight. I get it. It's not 100% comparable, but all in all, it's in the same bar because two fouls were initiated where you say, okay, well, this fighter doesn't have a history of doing it, and it didn't happen to where, you know, it buzzered, and then I stepped in, and then it was still all these punches being. Remember back when John Jones fought Daniel Cormier back in 2018, when Jones put his hands up at the end of, I believe it was, fifth. He put his hands up as if he won, and then who had him around the waist let go. But there were still like seconds left, like 4, 5, 6 seconds left on the clock. When Cormier let Jones turns around and clocks him, well, because it's only a few seconds left, he retaliates and throws a couple punches. Herdeen jumps in, grabs Cormier, and guess what? So now that not only did the buzzer go off and the round didn't grab you, and you're still trying to throw punches. Do we take points away then? Clearly, you know the round is over. No. So this idea that, oh, there's points taken away, I won't argue that, yeah, you know, there shouldn't have been points taken away. I wouldn't have minded if it was, although the score is 48-47 on all three judges for Jermaine. That means we would have had a tie, and nobody wants a tie. This isn't soccer. It's America. You're the first or you're last. But there has been times throughout history that have shown that if you do accidental fouls in that manner, we're not necessarily just going to take points away from you right away. So all this, oh, well, you know, the referee didn't know what he was doing. I get it that the referee you know, he was inexperienced in mixed martial arts, big fights like that. I get it. You know, he even said, I believe after the third round, he's going to try to be there more closely so that when the round ends, he can jump in quicker. And you saw that in the fourth and fifth round. When 10 seconds came, he was always in view, like right there, like, okay. Like, all right, bing, bing, and he just jumped in. And, you know, we didn't have the incident again for the next two rounds. But I'm not throwing my arms up in the air over this. To me personally, I don't feel that I look at history and say, you know what? In history, we've seen points taken away from George St. Pierre, points were taken from Cormier. It happened like she's Ross Parr's, who is in a bit line. Stepper and bending the rules, holding on to submissions way too long after the bell. The referee jumped in. This was like Jermaine's first time ever doing that. The stakes are high because of top line. You're in Brooklyn. The noise is loud. You know, don't hear it. So, yeah, I'm not totally up in the air about it. I'm not totally outraged, so to speak, about it. It is what it is. Jermaine, you know, she gets the victory, unanimous decision over Holland, five round bout. It wasn't the war we were expecting, but it was a fight nonetheless. Not one that's going to be a fight of the candidate, but it was a decent fight nonetheless between the two ladies. Afterwards, Jermaine was asked, you know, now that 145 is a brand new division, you're the first in. There's only three women in the UFC in this division. Two of them fought here, and there's one sitting case side, one Christina Cyborg Santos, who is the Victor, and I guess you could say 1-5 champion across the board, because I'm not sure if there's another 45-pound division for women out there at the major level of MMA, and not only the country, but in the world. I'm not sure about that, but she's the long-time reigning 145-pound champion. She's in K-side. Is she, you going to give her a title? And Jermaine says, you know, I wouldn't, if that's what I got to fight, that's what I'll fight. But here it comes. But I got to get hand surgery. I got torn. She didn't say broken. She said she tore some ligaments in her hand from a fight she had in 2015. It is 2017. What the hell have you been doing for a year and a half, 2 years? Fight she had in 2015. Let me just pull that up real quick. This right here is the tomfoolery we're talking about with all these fighters. She had a fight at UFC 185. This is 208. The UFC 125, March 2015, she had a fight against Larissa Pechico, and she won the fight, but that was in March of 2010. Jermaine didn't fight again until May 16. What the hell was you doing for that year? You didn't want to get the surgery then? She fought in May of 2016, and now she just fought most recently February of 2017. What the hell was you doing for almost this year? You had almost 2 full years of breaks in fights. You know, the 1 year for the one fight, almost a year between them. Why didn't you get the surgery then? Why didn't you get your work done then? And again, I get it. You know, maybe I could get through it. Maybe I could push through it. You know, kind of do the Kobe Bryant thing, not get surgery, just kind of let, you know, the muscle tissues grow over it. It is what I'm going to continue to fight. Got it. Especially considering, you know, at the title. Back in 2016, there was no mention that there was going to be a 145-pound division. There was no mention that Jermaine was anywhere close to a 135-pound title shot. What division that is in the U.S. So if you're not close to a title shot, why not get the surgery then? And look, I'm saying that, you know, as an ignorant fan who's on the outside looking in, I'm not a fighter. I understand the fighters don't get paid like they should. So, you know, financially wise, you know, it doesn't necessarily add up as far as only the cause, but then what I'll be losing inactive because I had to get the surgery, the time it takes to recover. I'm not able to earn the money that I could if I'm active. I get it. But now that you're the champion, miraculously, now that you're the champion, oh yeah, I got to get hand surgery. Oh yeah, it's been by, oh, yeah. Sounds like, you know, I don't want to say it's baloney. I don't want to say that, but it does sound a little fishy that you've been good since 2015 to fight. The fight that you had, you tore it. You fought two more times. You've been those two times. But now when they say Cyborg is on deck, oh yeah, coach, I need a believer. Hold on, I got a hand surgery I got to go do. Yeah, sounds kind of fitting. Isn't it interesting that all the top fighters in the UFC, all of them, the top ones, all said beforehand, if Cyborg was here, I'll gladly fight her. I'll move up to 145 to fight her. That's fine. I'll fight 40. I'll do it. Yeah. I think that'll be a good, tough fight. She's a good, tough opponent. I'll take that challenge. Cyborg comes to the UFC, is forced to fight twice 140 because the UFC did not want to make a 145-pound division because they didn't feel that division was stacked enough with enough good to justify a whole division. And who did she fight? Leslie Smith, newcomer to the UFC. Where were all the female fighters who said, fighter, I'll be willing to do it. Come on. Where were they at? Crickets. When they are offered a fighter, oh, I got this injury I got to go through. Oh, I get the waiting time. Oh, I got all this coming. Got it. Now, I understand Cyborg Santos is going through her own thing right now with USADA. But according to Dana White, things are for all you haters out there. Want to say, oh, it's nothing but steroids and this and that. Yeah, it's been close to, I believe, what, she busted hot in 2009, I believe? Or 2010? Yeah, what, 5-6 years? It's been a minute. It's been a minute. She fought twice in the UFC under USADA and passed every time. But, you know, she, you know, just like Yoel Romero, you know, where the tainted supplement, where it wasn't his fault. It was a bad supplement, just like Lyoto McKee, who's serving an 18-month suspension for something he didn't fail for. That's neither here nor there. But for all you haters out there, make sure you get your facts straight. Don't just say, oh, it's all steroids. It's the EDs using. She's a beer. Kick rocks. As a singer used to say, child please. That's right. I was able to work in a Ocho and child please on the show. Boom! But, yeah. We don't want to fight Cyborg. Why? Because she is scary. She is the boogeyman. She is the Chuck Norris of the women's division. The man checked underneath his bag for Cyborg Santos. So, you know, we'll see. I'm pretty sure Jermaine eventually will fight her. But then, miraculously, you know, with the hand surgery, and yeah, she'll fight Cyborg. Guess what? Jermaine, she'd be willing to give Holly Holm a rematch, given the controversial and how close the fight was. Match against Holly Holm. Before I got to step in there with her. No. Come on, cat. You know, just sit back. Let it happen. Just relax. Let it happen. Okay? You never know. You can catch her. You can throw an overhand right. Straight cross. A knee in the... You never know. It just goes to show you, Cyborg is one that nobody wants to face. But sooner or later, she's going to get in there with whoever the champion is, whether that's Jermaine or a future female fighter down the road. Sooner or later, she's going to get in there with her, and we'll see how that plays out. Also, see 208, we have the co-main event, Anderson and Spotted Silva taking on Derek Brunson. This right here on paper, it looked like, okay, Brunson, who is a good middleweight contender, he is a good fighter, but is he experienced enough? Is he good enough to take on Anderson Silva? We'll see. Anderson is, you know, on the wrong side of 40 right now, 41. So maybe he's slowing down just enough with Derek, with, you know, his Lawrence broad shoulders, his aggressiveness and his power, and with wrestling, maybe he can go in there and pull off the ultimate upset. And then, by golly, he can almost do so. controversial decision because many people feel that Derek Brunson won. And when I say many people, I don't just mean fan Twitter. I mean people who cover the sport, media personnel. Daniel felt Derek Brunson won. Obviously, Brunson himself felt he won. A lot of people felt Brunson won. And I've gone back and forth on if he did or if he didn't. I've gone back and forth. When I watched it live, when the fight was over, I said with the people that I was watching with, I said, I think Derek Brunson, I think he won. But I wouldn't be surprised if, and like, it was one of those fights where you got a feeling who won, but you wouldn't be upset the other one won. Like, it wouldn't be a robbery. It wouldn't be the worst call. It would just be like, okay, I can see that. It was one of those type of fights. And it's interesting because with Silva, see, Silva is such a harder to judge sometimes when he's in there because, you know, he is just crazy talented, gifted on so many levels, so many weapons in his arsenal on how he could beat you. But there's also a lot of times where Silva would kind of go on cruise control throughout the fight. It only takes about a full minute, maybe a minute and a half when the fight first starts before he even throws a kick or a punch. You know, just finding his range, you know, circling around, you know, just moving. So if you don't engage like Brunson, then you can get to the 333 mark before he throws something. And Brunson just threw out like a lazy front kick kind of just, all right, here you go. Here you go. So, yeah, it's, you know, it didn't start off fast, but when Silva would do his clinch, and Silva, who's a Muay Thai veteran, has one of the, in the UFC, asked Rich Frank twice about it, Derek Brunson was smart. He called to Chris Weidman. As soon as Silva was clinching on him, Brunson went his hands go, throwing hooks and uppercuts and just saying, nope, I'm not going to let you, look, I'm not going to try to fight the distance. Because a lot of times you get stuck in the clinch. You try to push off for distance. Well, with Silva, you don't want to do that because then he just throws those hard knees up at you and he's going to catch you in the body, on the chin or something. But Weidman showed, instead of trying to fight against it, because he's got such a hard, tough grip to break, throw punches, because he's not blocking them. You can't block the punches because you get your hands wrapped around my neck, so you can't block my fist, so I'm just going to throw punches. Weidman was able to drop him in their second fight with a right hook that, if you look at the replay, Silva was out. Silva's eyes rolled back, and it wasn't for the clinch where he was already holding Weidman, where he pulls him down on top of him. Weidman would have been able to get a dominant position and ground and pound, and that would have been all she wrote. I'm pretty sure Silva would have rather he went through that than a leg break. Still have nightmares about that. But that's what he was able to do throughout the entire fight. Whenever Silva was able to clinch with him, he would just go ahead and let his hands go. He got a couple of takedowns later in the fight, and you know, there was one at the end of round one, but it wasn't even a takedown. Silva went for a knee, didn't land, so when he fell again, he just grabbed Brunson by the back of the head, put him down on top of him. But when Brunson would get the takedowns, he didn't much. And here's the thing for wrestlers and for grapplers or anybody looking at it. Just because you get the takedown doesn't mean you automatically get a point. There's in boxing where, or wrestling where, if you get a takedown, you automatically get a point, or a knockdown, you actually get a point. Because the rounds are 5 minutes, you don't just, and the styles that are involved in it, you don't get points for a takedown. You know, you'll sometimes sit there with guys, and as soon as a takedown happens, oh, good job, good job, good job. Get that, get that, get that. So then you go ahead and you say, okay, you know what? Let's go ahead and let's see. Hold on one second. I'm having some technical difficulties here. 1 second. But, you know, you don't just, okay, well, we're going to go ahead and just get the takedown, and we're going to, no, you take a person down, you got to put it in work. You got to perk. You got to be able to say, you know what? I'm either going to submission. I'm going to try to advance. I'm going to get myself into a down position and ground and pound. Brunson didn't do a lot of that. He didn't do a lot of it. Silva was able to land some good kicks. Brunson landed a couple good kicks as well in his game. And then Brunson was able to, you know, he would tag off on Silva. Silva likes to put his hands down while he's back and kind of let you square up on him. So he'll allow you to hit him with some shots here and there. So that's one of the things that does happen. But let me go ahead and go to the phone line. We've got a caller, and I believe we got the Fallen Angel with us. Dominique, are you there? One second. I'll pull him up right now. I believe we have Dominique the Fallen Angel Robinson on the line. Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Thanks for calling in, man. What's good with you?
Not much, driving on these Vegas streets, handling business, but you know I have to call in, dog.
I gladly appreciate it. I know you are out there hustling and grinding like only you could do, man. I just got finished going on like a 20 or 30 minute about the main event of UFC 208. Talk to us about what you saw as a fighter and as Greg Blackston, what you saw of Holly Holm versus Jermaine Durandam.
Yeah, those scores were absurd to me. I was looking on Twitter, you know what I mean, looking at Trump America hating on Jermaine, saying Holly Holm won. Holly Holm didn't win that shit, and that fight wasn't a draw. If you look at, like, what she won pretty much every round. Because if you look at it, Holly Holm was holding her, never got any takedowns, didn't do any damage. And when they're in the clinch and Jermaine could get some space, Holly Holm was taking all the, like, big knees, you know. And in the striking exchanges, Jermaine was barely getting touched most of the fight. Holly Holm catching the counter right hand over and over and over and over again. And later in the fight, started catching the counter right hand and the left hook, you know. And I'm like, how is anybody even scoring this for Holly? You know, and Jermaine got kicked in the head, but everybody's acting like she was, like, rocked or messed up. But she went down, caught herself with two hands, got right back up, and went back on the attack. And then if you – the most controversial thing was the after the bell stuff and the way I looked at it. I looked at the first replay and people don't understand. She threw a knee. She threw a right knee, which was before the bell, followed by a 1-2. And if people watch closely, the one and the two went out before the bell, but the right hand of the 1-2 combo hit her like a fraction of a second after the bell went off. And the thing is, they say that's why you keep your hands up, you defend yourself, because it don't stop. And people must not understand this. It does not stop till the ref stops you. So, and you don't always hear that bell. And enough accountability isn't being held on the ref, not even getting in there on time. But you can't stop a combination. If you throw 1-2, it's going out. Holly should have had her hands up and everything. The second time, Jermaine was just late. You know, she was just late. It is what it is. But the ref wasn't there once again. So, you know, the first time was BS. The second time she was late. But the ref got to get in there and stop it.
Yeah, I was explaining earlier how after the first two, you know, the ref was saying, okay, I'm going to be there now. And you notice as for the rest of the rounds, every time that 10-second notice will come out, the referee would always be right there to make sure that he jumped quick enough. But, yeah, I was also explaining how if you looked at it, you know, it's a matter of an opinion, but Jermaine's hand was already kind of and ready to throw the punch as the bell went off. So it's almost like you want me to stop in mid-motion. And then I brought up the example of when George St. Pierre fought Matt Hughes the second time for the title, he hit two low kicks when he's throwing an inside kick and his foot hit him low. They didn't take a point away from those, and John McCarthy said, if you do it again, I'm going to have to take a point. So even though they're not exactly the same, I'm saying it's not unusual for the ref let two accidental fouls go to say, okay, if you do it again, then I got to deduct a point from you. So it was an interesting fight, and I wanted to ask you this. What did you think about afterward? Jermaine's the champion. Cyborg is sitting there, the uncrowned champion, and then all of a sudden – well, I got to get a hand surgery for an injury I suffered back in 2015. You're a fighter that had surgery long after you injured. I mean, to the out fans, it looks like, oh, now she's ducking her. Can you shed light on, hey, you just don't understand what these fighters go through with the injuries, or is this kind of a coincidence that all of a sudden now I need hand surgery and Cyborg's on deck?
You know, I personally know her. And that girl doesn't back out of a fight. And people are talking about our best female kickboxer of all time, along with Lucia Riker, with damn near all knockouts on her record. And they want to say, oh, well, you fought the best strikers in the world, and now you're afraid of the best female MMA striker or female MMA fight. There's no logic to that. You know, this is like people projecting how they would feel in that situation. Because if you look at it, there's just no logic. She fought the best strikers in the world, and she's in the UFC fighting people. And if you look at striking credentials, her, Johanna, and Holm, credential-wise, are the best strikers for females in MMA. So why would she be scared to fight Cyborg? And she said that she had the injury for a while. Of course, you aren't going to get it handled if you have a title fight. You know, I had a broke rib and fought Carlo Prater on like 2 weeks' notice. When you get a title fight, if you're a real fighter, you're going to take it. You know, it's what you're going to do. So I'm not surprised she took the fight with Holm with her hands still messed up. And if you're going to fight Cyborg, you have to be at 100%. Why do another fight in another camp with torn ligaments in your hand, you know? So that's my perspective on it.
And that's an absolutely good point. But like I said, the hand injury came fight in 2015. It was in March of 2015. She didn't fight again until May of 2016. And then didn't fight again until the past weekend. So she almost had like a year and a half, almost 2 years from the injury till this fight with Holm to get it fixed. If she got it injured in 2015, she could have got it fixed then. But I was also saying how, you know, you just don't understand that when you're not one of the top main fighters yet making the big bucks, it's kind of hard to opt out for surgery. By the time that it takes you to recover while you're on the shelf, that's earnings that you could be missing on. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. It's either, yeah, you know, bad, but you still should have got it. Or it looks like, as you said from the world, it looks like you're just scared of her, which shouldn't necessarily be the case. This was a pretty weird event because there was controversy in the main event. As you said, you didn't see it that way, but Amanda did. But then in the co-main event, there was also controversy because Anderson Silva gets the win over Brunson. I was in the middle of breaking that fight down. How do you see the Silva versus Brunson match going? Is it controversial, or do you stand on the other side and say, nah, I don't see it that way?
You know, that fight, and I hate to bring up Pride because I know completely different shit. Pride rules, Anderson won, you know. But UFC rules, this 10, you know, 10-point must system, which I hate. I personally would have gave it a draw. Because if you're going to use the 10-point must system, most of the damage outside of, like, uppercuts and a clinch from Darren Brunson, he didn't do anything else. The damage was done by Anderson Silva. And Brunson held him. And unfortunately, in this sport, you can win fights holding people. So if we're going to look at it the way they do score, Anderson got held more, but he hit Brunson with the more damaging shot. So, you know what I mean? In order to not let anybody get ripped off, if that's the way you want to score things, score the draw. You know, give Brunson his draw for being boring and home to do, you know, and give Anderson his draw for trying to fight the guy, you know? If it was my way, it's a fight. The point of a fight is damage. And how else are you going to win a fight? And I think they need to do something about the scoring system, but to stick to the point, I think that fight should have been a draw. You know, I saw Derek Brunson said he outclassed the greatest ever. You know, somebody need to tell that dude what outclass means, because that ain't what he did. You know?
Not at all. If anything, he more so looked like he was in awe and in shock of with Silva, because there were large gaps where Brunson would be moving away, not really throwing anything back at Silva. And we would, not like you said, outside of the clinch when I was breaking that down, where he kind of did, man, whenever Silva clinched him, Brunson would just let his hands go. He didn't want to let his hands go. And when he got the takedown, anything on the ground to cause damage, and that's something you see with a lot of wrestlers, that they get guys down and they kind of just hold them there and they just pepper them, which not necessarily go for damage. So, you know, it's one of those, again, it's a matter of perspective. When I first saw it, my first thought told Brunson won, like my first thought. But as we're waiting for the scorecard, I was thinking back and I was looking at some of the highlights and I said, you know what? I could see a draw there, but I could see Silva getting the win just because he was more active, a little bit more, not just because it was flashy, but he did do more. It's when you got someone that, you know, takes you down and sits on top of you, it looks like they're winning even doing anything. Even on the third round,
yeah.
Silva was throwing elbows from the bottom.
Yeah,
me and you
and
talked
Brunson
about this.
No like, he didn't do any damage. And part of the scoring criteria is aggression. And he was going backwards the whole fight. You know, but he literally, I know you talked about bringing shots. He didn't even do that. I was watching that third round. I was like, man, he got Silva down, man. I don't know how they're going to score this. But when he was doing zero damage and an elbow from the bottom, I'm like, wait a minute. He's doing, like, literally nothing. Not even, like, the peppering shots. He just did nothing but hold the dude there.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, he did what Chael Sonnen did to Silva and just pretty much pity pat him the whole time. At least look like you're doing something. But when you're just laying there taking a nap on him, it's like, dude, did you take between rounds? What the hell is going on?
I don't know. And you know what? Anderson wasn't even in the Matrix neither. Derek Brunson should have just did the same way he did with Uriah Hall and go for it. But like you said, it was like he was like in awe.
Yeah, I thought when the third round, I thought Brunson really should have turned it up and tried to push the action more forward. I know you want to be cautious with a fighter like Silva because he can always catch you, but I just thought in the third round with the fight being close, Brunson really should have been a little bit more aggressive forward and whatnot. Now, me and you talked about it on last week's show, how the middleweight division, you know, it's kind of cluttered right now at the top. Who gets the next shot at Bisping? You know, Romero obviously is eliminated, but Jacare Souza gets an impressive first-round victory. Tim Boach is ranked number 13, but a first-round submission victory. What did you make of Jacare's performance, and where does he go from? He said he's not going to sit and wait. That's not in his nature. What do you do with Jacare?
Man, I don't know what to do with him, man. That dude's Tim Boach, he looked like he was in there to fight. I was like, oh, this might be a better fight than I thought. Man, it touched the ground, dude.
Yeah,
it was over. I was like, God damn. It wasn't even a technical Kimura. He just, like, tore it off. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what to do. I don't even know what to do with that guy next. You know, like, what do you do with him? Because there's nothing else you can do with him but let him fight the champion, you know? But then that fight's booked with Yoel. So it's like, come on, man. You got to do – if he's going to fight, it has to be something interesting. Like, it got to be something – like, you got to put him versus Nick Diaz. Or, like, some kind of super fight. Give him something to compensate for not fighting for the title, which he should be. Because nothing else outside of some special fight or the belt makes sense with the guy, you know?
Nah, definitely. With Jacare being on the win that he is and, you know, being so close to a title, I wouldn't recommend it. But, I wonder if he could ever move up to 205. And take a light heavyweight fight, like we've seen someone like Anderson Silva did when he was a champion. There was nobody at 185 for a little bit, so he goes up and fights James Irvin and Stephen Bonner and Forrest Griffin.
That's a good idea. Not to mess with his 85 rankings, but
exactly.
I agree with you. He has to do a 205 special fight or a special 85 fight if he's not fighting for that belt. But I got to go right now. I'm about to do some more business. I have to call in, though, and give you some love, man.
Hey, appreciate it so much, Dominique. Man, you take care out there. Look forward to talking to you later on. Y'all, thanks, Fallen Angel Robinson.
All right, my man.
Together. You guys be sure to follow Dominique on social media, Fallen Angel 5 on all social media accounts, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and all that goodness. Business information there as well. The Fallen Angel coming in with the good knowledge and breakdown of fight. Certainly going to have him back on the show in the future. So, yeah, like me and Dominique were just saying, you know, it's unfortunate that Jacare is in this position that, you know, you got Yoel Romero basically slugging the next shot at Michael Bisping for the title, even though Jacare's fight against Romero was a bit controversial. So maybe you run that back, but they're not. What do you do with Jacare? Again, I wouldn't mind seeing him go up to 2 if he can make that weight. He is kind of a big 185er, so if he can make that weight, you put him in there against somebody at 5, maybe a Glover Teixeira. I haven't seen anything suggest that they're close friends like Jacare and Silva are, so you can do that fight. Glover Teixeira, who was on his card, he got a victory over Jared Cannonier, so maybe you can do that fight. Gustafsson, possibly. Bader looks like he's going to Bellator, so that could be Jimmy Manawa, maybe OSP, you know, somebody like that, possibly. Shogun, you know, I don't know if him and Shogun are close friends because, you know, they're both from Brazil. So if they're not close friends, where they wouldn't want to fight each other. Jacare versus Show going to be a good one. But real quick, back to the Anderson Silva Derek Brunson fight. Yeah, for Silva, he even busted out a capoeira move in there, a nice dance that was nice to watch. You got to start wondering that at 40, 41 years old, is father time starting to catch up to the spider? Is it starting to affect him? Because as Dominique said, he wasn't the Matrix up there. He wasn't out there doing anything that made you say, wow. And maybe it was just a matchup, but at this point in stage in his career, he kind of sounded like he was close. He sounded like he was closer to retirement than he's ever talked about it before. Before, whenever it's come up, he's always shut it down really quick. Always like, no, he's normal. I love to fight, and I want to go out there. And that's all fine and dandy. He says he continues to fight because it's in his heart. That's what he does. Nothing but respect somebody that feels that way. So you do also have to look at it and say, well, big enough name, and he did get a nice victory here, though, so maybe if he gets one more victory, it's possible he can get a title shot, maybe. But I think the best thing for the UFC to do for Silva is not put him in these fights against these young up-and-comers. If you're going to put him in, let him fight guys who are clearly established, sort of. Would you guys like to see a rematch with Anderson Silva and Vitor, both at the end their careers, both now look like they usually but still are big enough names. It was brought up that the UFC is heading back to Brazil in June, I believe. So, back to in Brazil. Come on now. It can't get no bigger than that, right? What about Silva versus Nick Diaz, too? They talked about maybe doing a rematch with each other. The first fight went to a decision. Some people felt Diaz won. Others felt that Silva won. Maybe you run that. That'll be a big enough fight to get Nick Diaz to finally accept the fight to come back to UFC, correct? So maybe you go that route. There is one fight, though. It needs to be made now, more than ever. We were robbed of this fight for many years. But now, in seeing how Silva looked against Brunson, I think it's the perfect opportunity to not only make this fight, but I think it's the perfect opportunity for an opponent of a to take advantage of this. And I'm talking about Anderson Silva taking on George St. Pierre. Now, George is not a UFC. He has not come back, but he is oh so close. Talks with the UFC, and he wants to come in there and do it. Got it. But because for so many years we wanted to see this super fight, and we just never got to see it. And obviously, they were both champions. Welcome George, middleweight for Anderson Silva. George was saying how, me fighting at 170, I walk around at about 185, 90. Silva walks around clearly way over 210. So when we fight, he's going to have the size advantage. I've talked before on the show in the past, if you guys remember, when you got two guys who are equal in skill set, the one who has advantage is now the one with the size. If you look back to when Rich Franklin and Forrest fought each other, they both had similar skill sets and were pretty much even across the board. But why was it such a one-sided fight? Because Forrest Griffin was the much bigger fighter. He dwarfed Rich Franklin when they were fighting. Not just height, but just body size. But 230, 240, that fight, when they went in there, Franklin, around what, 220, 225? Just couldn't compete with him. But it wasn't the way we were all would be just because of the size. And that's what George was saying is, I'm not as scared of Silva, but I'm taking on someone who is just naturally bigger than me. It's put me at the disadvantage where, what's the point? So, but you look at it and you say, well, Silva looks just a step slower. Obviously, he's not going to look to go in there and ruffle you up against the cage and try to go for takedowns and lay on top of you. No, he's going to stand up with you, strike with you. If you do take him down, he's going to look to throw out the bottom, eventually try to get a submission on you. He's got good submissions, but he takes the longest to set them up. I mean, by gosh. But right now, Silva versus GSP sounds, there's never been a more important time to make it happen. And right now, with WME being the owners of UFC, they want these big fights because they're trying to make their money on a $4 billion investment when they bought the UFC, and they're all about entertainment. What's more entertaining than getting two biggest names in the sports history to fight each other? At 185, GSP's talked about he'll fight Michael Bisping at 185, not Silva. Silva's talked about he could drop down to 180, 175 maybe, 177 if he wants to fight. Why not do that? Silva talked about wanting to fight Conor McGregor. How awesome would that be? Conor McGregor and Silva at a catchweight. Probably wouldn't have. I mean, whew, it would be fun. McGregor would be, if the size advantage of Nate Diaz gave him trouble, imagine the advantage of Anderson Silva giving him trouble. My gosh, it would be fun to watch. But yeah, I think though GSP and Silva needs to happen now more than ever before Silva away. But if not, you know, Nick Diaz, Belfort 2, those are all good rematches that would. I don't want to see him face Luke Rockhold. I don't want to see him face Yoel Romero. I want to see him go at it again with Chris Weidman. I don't want to see him get on these younger guys because, you know, I just feel when you get older fighters, more often than not, it's matching up with guys who fit what they can do. If you look, remember Dan Henderson before he was. There were fights where Dan just did not look good at all. Like, he looked old, slow. Like, he didn't deserve to be in there anymore. And granted, when he fought Burr twice, no, they're around the same age. He's a little bit older, but they're around the same age, so you got it. But when did he look bad? When he fought all younger guys. Lombards. DC's an older guy, so he got ragdolled that one, but that was at 205. But he was in there with guys like Hector Lombard, Tim Bochashine. Guys who were a little bit older to him to where, you know, they weren't necessarily in the crop. He was able to look good. Give us some great fights, especially the one Shogun, Fight of the Year. So I think with Silva, you know, it's not cherry picking at this point in his career. You know, it's not going to get his legacy. It's not going to do any damage to his legacy. But you put him in there like you did with BJ Penn and put him in with somebody in their 20s or early 30s to where they'll just flat out embarrass them because they have this athletic advantage over Silva. Give him some guys he can match up really well against to say, hey, if you're at the end of your road and middleweight division is just too stacked right now, we got Yoel Romero and Jacare waiting for titles. Luke Rockhold possibly waiting for one. Weidman needs to come back with a nice victory. Gang Mousasi, if he demon, how do we tell him that he still got to wait for a title shot? Oh, yeah, because Ray's got to wait. They're all behind Romero now. And then we'll see what happens with that. So, and Bisping has already said that, you know, he wants a big money fight. So what's a bigger money fight with Silva? We'll see. Also on the card, you know, like I said, Jarrett got a victory. Fight of the night went to Dustin Poirier and versus Jim Miller. He got the decision. Majority over Jim Miller. What a scratch as these two guys went at it. Jim Miller, I mean, my gosh, man. He is all wars, always in good fight. It's never a dull moment. So if you see Jim on the call, be sure to check out his fights. Dustin Poirier, another exciting guy, that looked very good at lightweight, was bouncing back off a defeat out and got one here. But word around the circuit is that he did have a leg injury, whether it was broken, fractured, or something of the nature. But the legs from Jim Miller were really hammering. After the fight, he couldn't even stand up and walk. He needed help from his corner. See, that's what I'm talking about earlier when I was talking about Holly Holm versus Jermaine. When Holly was throwing all those leg kicks, she was only slapping her foot. Miller was able to put the torque in there because he had the foot, the ankle, the shin, all on the foot, on the leg, and look what happened. Poirier couldn't even walk afterwards. That's what you want to do if your game plan is a throwing leg kick. You want to chop him like Rocky did in Russia against that tree with Drago. Conor McGregor, when he fought Nate Diaz, you know, he been afterwards because he was throwing so many kicks to Diaz's leg, but Diaz was a good amount of them. But he was throwing so many kicks, he was hurting his shin and his foot because, hey, you know, I was throwing kicks at him. So that's what I was talking about in that instance right there. Fight of the night, Poirier Miller, performance of the night, Jacare with the first round submission or Tim Boach. So, you know, 208, you know, wasn't spectacular. Wasn't, you know, it wasn't what it could have been. It really was something where people were saying, and see, this is the thing. The UFC, you got to wonder, because they just got into New York all three times that New York, where it was UFC 205 in Square Garden, the one in Albany in December, and then the one. There might have been, I think that was only three times they've been to New York. Had some type of controversy. This one was the judging and the referee. The 205 one was a thing with the medical. And it's always something. And you just got to say, for the UFC, maybe they should make their fights in New York more fight night cards so that the New York State Athletic Commission can get more adjusted to how things operate within the MMA world, how judging works, how the officiating works, medical issues, the one, all that other stuff. Maybe they can go there. I say that, and I believe UFC 210, that's going to be in Buffalo. That's a pay-per-view with Corey and Rumble, too. So, yeah. Well, you know, they're in New York, and they're going to go there as often as they can. So it is what it is, but I definitely think that's something that will benefit them more. The next time you check out the UFC will be February 19th, UFC Fight Night, Lewis versus Brown. Derek the Beast Lewis takes on Travis Browney in the main event. Two heavyweights going at it. You're also going to have a middleweight clash between Hector Lombard taking on Ronnie Hendricks, who's making his middleweight debut. The former welterweight champion has notoriously had issues with weight problems, cutting down to 170, making his way to 185 debut. That should be an interesting one. If you also look hard, Sarah McMahon is going to be fighting as well. Carlos Esparza is going to be fighting. Yeah, Santos, Paul Felder. So, you know, this is an interesting card. You know, this card right here is more so for the dark fans. This is more so for the hardcore fans. But if you're a fan, hey, you just never know. You're trying to get into the UFC, you watch these cards. You know, there was some time ago where there was a young Irish guy on a fight night card that nobody really knew much about here in America. And now we call him the notorious Conor McGregor. So you just never know where you're going to see these stars at. This Brazilian coming in from Pride, taking on Chris Leben. And in 48 minutes, Anderson Silva showed everybody, yeah, I'm the baddest guy around. But before that, you know, it was in a casino out here in Las Vegas. It wasn't the big arenas. So, you know who you're going to see on this card, what excitement you're going to see here, and we'll check it out then, and we'll break the card down for you guys on next week's show. This coming weekend, we are going to see some bouts real quick. Oh, real quick, before I leave UFC 208, one I just want to bring up, the UFC was Dana White was bashing the referee of the referee Todd Anderson for his officiating, not taking a point from Jermaine the Randomie for the two late hits. Obviously, me and Don talking about it, and he was saying, you know, he's just inexperienced for the main of the title fight. Should have been another referee in there. Well, the New York State Athletic Commission caught today and said the UFC knew well in advance who the referee was for the championship bout and did not object to it. So, UFC, if you're going to call out the referee for not being experienced enough, not having, you know, the in-ring time to know how to initiate a championship bout, time ago that he was a referee and you said nothing. Who dropped the ball here? Us or you? So that's interesting to see how that works out. And see, that's just another UFC and the New York State Athletic Commission really need to work together to really iron out a lot of these miscommunications going on between them. But this weekend, this Saturday, Bellator 172 from San Jose, California. He's back. Emelianenko makes his debut for Bellator and his return to this nearly 6 years. He is going to be taking on Matt Mitrione. This is going to be an interesting bout, to say the least. You got Fedor, 36-4, 10 KO, 17 subs, making his long-awaited return to American soil. When he was here for Affliction and Strike Force, he went 3-3. Three finishes to start, three finishes to end. So, average. This was dating all the way back to 2009. As I said, all six of his bouts were by stoppages. His last were finishes. So, you know, he had a submission to Doom, the TKO loss to Bigfoot Silva, and then knocked Dan Henderson, who that was his only time ever fighting up at heavyweight. So, yeah. After that, Fedor had on the fighter, then he retired in 2012. But then he comes back in 2015, fights over there in Russia, for an event, and another one in Russia. And, you know, he's 2-0 since his return, but he does have the one major controversy from his last outing when he went over Fabio Maldonado from Brazil. Many people felt like Fabio won, and when you watch it, it's clear that he did, but it was in Russia. So what did you expect? They pulled the ultimate okey-doke on him. And I was in June of last year, but now you're coming back to fight in the cage, coming back to America, making his debut for Bellator. This is going to be interesting. And for Fedor, there's always been this mystique about him. There's always been, oh, Last Emperor, is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. And I've never – it's hard for me to really give him that type of a credit. It's hard for me to really say that Fedor is the GOAT. It's really hard for me to say Fedor is as great as he's been. It doesn't mean I'm wrong. I'm not saying he's bad. I'm not saying that. That's the thing. When people say, oh, this guy's overrated. Oh, how can you say he's overrated? No, overrated. You're not a 10. You're an 8. You're an 8.5. You're a 9, 7. I mean, you're a bum. You know, it doesn't mean you're a bum, but that's how people take it for one reason or another. But anyway, you got Fedor who, it was great for me to buy into him because, one, I always look at it like this. You know, the NBA isn't the only basketball league in the world, but it's the biggest one. That, you know, you can go overseas and you can play in Russia and Germany and China, Italy, and all these around the world, and you become a star and you become a legend. You know where you get your basketball accolades from? Doing it in the NBA. Arvydas Sabonis from Lithuania, a beast internationally. When he finally came to America, the Portland Trailblazers, he was older, injuries piled up, and he was bigger in the body. But he showed you with a nice soft touch and pass in the shit and his toughness. He showed you, hey, had I came over earlier, had it not been for my love for my country, me wanting to be there with my family, and the politics that be back in these days from overseas, I'd have been a bad mamma jamma. So you guys are lucky, okay? Yucky. But, you know, you get your accolades from playing in the biggest, just like in soccer. You can be the best major league soccer guy, but you know what? You got to go overseas and play in one of those leagues. I'm not sure of all the league names. You got to play in the leagues. You can't just say, well, I'm playing here and doing my thing. You know, oh, I was real big in junior college as a football guy. Yeah, you know, when you get your accolades, go to Division I and show what you can do there. Very few times do you get a chance to say, yeah, well, you know, this guy's Division III or Division II, and he made it to the NFL. You don't get those stories too often. Now, as far as Fedor, you know, he's got wins over a lot of great fights. He's beaten O'Gara several times. He beat Sammy Schilt. He's Gary Goodridge. You know, he's got Moman, Kevin Randleman. And Kevin Randleman nearly spiked him on his head. He'll beat him. Got Mirko Krokop, for God's sake. He's got Mark Hunt, Matt Lindland, Andre Arlovski, which that was just crazy because Arlovski tries going for a flying knee, gets caught midair, then gets face planted. So he's got legit wins, but he's also got a lot of circles in there as well. For all those fighters that I just named, he's got a bunch of guys, karate guys who weren't MMA guys, a judo who I believe in his first fight back in 2015, Lita Manny gone, only had one MMA fight. It was like 4 years ago, 4 years before that. You know, taking on professional Japanese wrestlers in the MMA bout. Really? Taking on, you know, 6 foot, 9 foot circus fighters. Taking on wrestlers. Really? The greatness? This is the GOAT? That's what we're climbing? This who we're going to? Really? Guy who half of his victories come against circus climbers? Bus boys, mailman drivers, really? Come on now. So, you know, I'm not trying to sit here and say Fedor isn't good, but as great as he is, yeah, look, he's in a conversation with heavyweights of all time. He's in that conversation. But when I also look back, when you came to America to take on guys, and he wasn't in the UFC, he was in Strikeforce, and you went 3-3. Well, he was much older back then. So this was back in 2009. which make that 8 though. He's 40 now, so you were 32, 33. I just thought about Anderson Silva being 40. Randy Couture fought till he was almost 50. Dan Henry fought till he was 45. Old? Michael Bisping is the middleweight champion. He's at the end of 30. Yo Romero, about to be 40. Old? 30s? No. Come on now. You know, Fedor is going to come in, and he's going to try a nice Bellator run. Bellator's got some pretty decent heavyweights there. They got a couple of light heavyweights who can move heavyweight, like Rampage and King Mo. So you never know what we're going to see there. We'll never know what type of fighter we're going to see in Fedor. You know, it was a mixed bowl of nuts the first time he was in Strikeforce. We'll see in Bellator. But I'll tell you what, he's taking out who's not easy on him, and Matt Mitrione. Matt Mitrione, who's 11-5 with 10 KOs, is a tough, tough cookie. There were times in his UFC career where, you know, he was like one or two away from really getting a big fight, or at least maybe in talks with a title contention, and he just wouldn't be able to trigger. Yeah, I don't know what it was. I don't know if a mental block, confident, underestimating his opponent or what, but it's like, you know, he has a nice little win streak. He started his UFC career with 5 straight wins. You know, he get like 5 straight wins, 3 wins here, 2 good here, and then it's like, okay, we're going to get somebody, and Matty. But he's a tough, tough cookie. Former NFL player, and he's not taking it easy on him. He's 2-0 on tour. Both of them are by finish. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see Mitrione and Fedor go against each other. For Matt, this is the biggest fight of his career. It's an opportunity for him to really put his name out there for people to know, hey, I might have to. He gets a win here. How do you not give him a title shot next? Fedor here, he'll probably get a title shot. And Bellator needs that. That's why you're seeing so many ex-UFC fighters over there. Not only do those guys want to fight, and Bellator is saying, yeah, but they understand the name recognition and value of it. Then, you know, you get guys with the name from other people, but then you also stack it with your own local fighters that the fans will know. Hey, good business. So that's going to be an interesting matchup right there, too. In the co-main event, we're going to see the return of Josh Thompson. Thompson, 22-8 with 10 submissions. Hasn't fought since December of 2015, so how's he going to look? This is a guy who at one point in time was supposed to be the best lightweight in the world, one of the dangerous and scarce guys at 155, and he's another one for one another, whether it was injuries or just a bad fight. He just couldn't get to the next level at the big promotions, specifically the UFC. So, you know, for him, it is going to be interesting to see how he does after such a long layoff, and it is going to be intriguing to see if he is successful here. Do Bellator shoot him straight up against Ben Henderson, or do they kind of like let him get another 2 fights, you know, let him get his foot in the ground, kind of build a name from snap promotion? We'll see. Also on the card, we got Chet Congo, another former UFC fighter. He's going to be fighting there. Chet, good heavyweight, 7-2 on Bellator. Never really reached, you know, the upper echelon portion of the division, but good fighter, good kickboxer as well. And then we're going to see the debut of Josh Koscheck, finally. Josh Koscheck, who's 17-10 in his 2015, ended his UFC run on a 5-fight losing skid. Ugh. And then you got to wonder, can he bounce back from a row being off for almost 2 years, and he's 39 years old? You got to wonder. Josh Koscheck never looked the same since he lost to George St. Pierre at the same time when George St. Pierre shattered his orbital bone with a jab and just humiliated him for all that trade with coaches opposite each other on the Ultimate Fighter when he got in at Tate's face. In fact, I might have to try to see if I could get Brad Tate to show sometime. We're friends on Facebook. I might have to try to see if I could get him on. I told you, you got 17. I'm going to try to get more guests. I got Dominique coming on here for those. So I'm definitely going to try to see if I get some other guys out there. If you guys are listening to any ideas of who you'd like to see on here, look, I'm only a small local boy doing this podcast. So me trying to get John Jones, Ronda Rousey, Conor McGregor, that's a bit of a far stretch. But anybody else at the mid to lower levels, even if they're not necessarily fighters, referees, announcers, nutmen, whatever the case may be, I am going to try to get them on here. I'm gonna try to get some wrestlers on here as well, some wrestling and indie scenes. I'm gonna try to get some bodybuilders on here, some people in the fitness industry, because that also plays into fighting. We talked about it last week. You know, how much does fitness go into fighting? As much, how much should you pay attention to it? So I'm definitely gonna try to bring you guys a lot of variety as far as guests going forward here. I know you guys can't enjoy this voice that much, although I hope you do. So yeah, going forward, that's gonna be wrapping up the show here. Well, we still got a little bit of time, but word through the grapevine is that UFC strawweight champion Joanna Jack could be set to defend her title against Jessica Andrade in May at UFC 211 in Dallas, Texas. Y'all, that is going to be a tremendous fight between like Jessica Andrade, who fought last weekend against Angela Hill, and oh man, when we talking about her looking like the billion juggernaut. Girl, short, compact, muscular, aggressive, powerful, very strong, and she just keeps on coming. She is the number one contender right now at the women's 150 division, and she's going to get a shot against Joanna Young Jacek. That is going to be a very good fight. That is going to be one for them. So, I can't get into it in great detail because, again, anything could happen, you know, scheduling conflicts, injuries, or whatever. But Joanna, she's 13-0, and she's 13-0, and obviously she's a champion. She won the title back in 2015, yeah, March 2015 in UFC 185, and she so far has defended it 1, 2, 3, 4 times. So, you know, this will be her fifth title defense against Jessica. Just a nice win streak of her own as well. So, if the fight does happen, that is going to be a nice fight to check out down there in Dallas. UFC 211 plus is going to be headlined by Stipe Miocic versus Junior Dos Santos 2 for the heavyweight championship. Stipe looking to make his second successful title. And JDS looking to reclaim the title that he won. The fighters who was able to win the UFC title multiple occasions. Randy Couture is on that list. Who else is on the heavyweight? Tim Sylvia is on that list. Yeah, Tim Sylvia, Randy Couture, Cain Velasquez, Junior Dos Santos. Yeah, if Junior wins, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, he'll be only the first member in the UFC's heavyweight division to ever win the title, I'm imagining. So, you know, that'd be a part of history for him going forward. Well, again, this is Inside the Octagon, which you guys can listen to every Monday from 6 to 7:30 Pacific Standard Time. You guys can listen to that podcast every Thursday evening from 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Some good stuff going on. Multitude of sports, football, baseball, basketball, a little bit of boxing in there sometimes. So be sure to check that out. You guys can also follow me on Twitter at KLUA11. That's KLUA11. Follow my sports page on Facebook. That is All Things Sports on Facebook. Real quick, wanted to talk about this a little bit going forward is, you know, with Jermaine Dupri now being the women's 155 champion, and obviously, you know, there's an obvious cyber connection there going, but then, you know, will she fight or will she fight Holly Holm? You know, one thing I'm starting to notice now with these new champions is these new champions are becoming, you know, they get the title, and right away when they get the title, they want a big money fight. Now they want the big money fight. We saw it with Cody Garbrandt, Drew Cruz. You know, now he wants the 145 to take on Jose Aldo, wants to take on Conor McGregor, possibly even Holloway. You know, he wants that. Amanda Nunes was talking about, you know, doing a super fight, moving up to 145 and catching belts. And I got to tell you, one thing about these champions is I understand what they're trying to do. You're trying to cash in while you can, get the big while you can, no shame in that. But you also realize not all of you got McGregor. Conor was able to do it, and this is kind of the double-edged sword of the UFC. The UFC knows that if they let Conor McGregor fight out of weight class, you know, trying to chase history the one time, they know that they're going to get over 1 million pay-per-views, They know that they're going to cash in. It's going to be a big payday. They know that. But the other side is that if you allow him to do it, now you got all these new champions saying, now they want to do it. they want to be two division champions. They want to go after somebody in another division so that they can get a big money fight. Their names aren't as out there. That's something I don't knock the fighters for to challenge them so they get the big money fights, but they also have to understand, you have to get to that point. You can't just demand the big money fights, because only called a big money fight because people are willing to pay for it. They're not willing to pay if they know who the hell you are. So for these fighters, you got to defend title to the number one contender. You got to get a couple title defenses and clean out that division a little bit. And then say, yeah, I'll move up. You never heard John Jones talk. He moved up to heavyweight to fight when he was champion. Silva, he never wanted to fight 205 at the champion. He just said, I'm going to take on a couple fights. I'm the 185 champion. It's normal. Georges St. Pierre, I'm the 170. I'm good. BJ Penn, he tried one time. That's it. Went back and said, yeah, I'm going to clean out the division. But BJ Penn and Anderson Silva both moved up to the other divisions above them when there was no number one contender in their own respective divisions. There are clear contenders at 135 for both the male and the women. There are clear contenders at 45, 55. So, you know, that's to all these brand new champions and for the ones we'll see in the future. When you get it, don't just think. You have to build up your cachet, so to speak, to be able to demand the big money fights. You know, that's like you coming to the NFL and say, well, I'm a starting quarterback, so I want 17 to 18 million dollars, because that back market demands. You're a back. Now, sure, you get someone who gets a big contract, Osweiler. That was a big mistake by the Texans. And look, they're already talking about moving on from him. So you got to be able to earn your turn. You know, you got to be able to, you know, you got to be candy with the stealing hand and earn your keep. Regulators. So, you know, I don't mind big fights. I don't mind people. I don't mind super fights. But the only super, if it's too big name, you know, you just like out there in the comic, in the movie world, Batman, Superman. It ain't Aquaman versus Cyborg. Nobody's going to see that. But we'll see bigger names. Yeah, we'll see that. It's Iron Man and Captain America, not Falcon versus War Machine. For the fighters, go out there and earn your turn. Earn your keep. Show people what you can do out there. Get a fan base. Get a stronger fan going. Get the casuals knowing who you are. And then you're able to demand the bigger fights. Then you're able to do it. Ronda Rousey, for all her intents and purposes, she was great. I make the money I make because the UFC knows that they're going to be able to get their money back when they put her. Same thing with McGregor. Same thing with Jones. Same thing with Lesnar. What about Brock Lesnar? When he's on, million pay-per-view buys. People are going to tune in, and you're going to make your money back, and then some. So it is what it is. Well, for these fighters, you know, I don't want to try to go out there and do it, but you know what? You kind of got to build yourself first. That's my little rant on that. You guys be sure to check out this show again next week, next day, and every Monday from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific time. Check out the script to listen to on Thursdays from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard. Follow me on Twitter at KLUA11. That's KLUA1. Also, my sports page on Facebook, All Things Sports. That is All Things Sports on Facebook. Until next time, y'all take care. Have a good one. Be safe and smile.